All right, everybody, welcome. I'm producer Dave, and I'm joined by Professor Roderick Graham. He's an associate professor of sociology and criminal justice at Old Dominion University, and he's the host of Conversations and Perspectives on YouTube. What's up, man? How you doing, Rod?
Hey, I'm good, man, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on. You come highly recommended. I found you through a friend of mine, Brandon Bradford, and anybody that guy likes, I like. Like I was telling you beforehand, Brandon was one of the first people I met when I moved to the San Jose area. So super nice guy. So maybe tell us a little bit more about yourself before we get started here.
Okay, yeah, sure, man. I am a professor of sociology and criminal justice. I do a lot of research on online criminal behavior and deviance. That's kind of like my main gig. However, I'm on YouTube and Twitter and social media a lot because I just kind of got involved in these culture war things. And as someone who's an academic, I can always tell when, you know, people are saying things that aren't true or misrepresenting stuff. And so I just kind of dived in with that. And that's probably how I'm ending up here. And met Brandon the same way, actually, because we're both complaining, you know, pushing back against these anti-wokes and crazy people. So, yeah.
Yeah, it the current like state of discourse, specifically around critical race theory, is frustrating, especially for someone like me, because I'm a layperson. Like our show, I'm really good at spotting like conspiracy theories and like kind of cult-like behavior. And we've been covering a lot of moral panics. We have a show later tonight about the satanic panic. So I'm kind of good at spotting that stuff when it comes around. But I don't have the background to really explain what other people should know. So I guess kind of my first question for you is like, what do you think lay people should know about critical race theory, especially as it pertains to like when we engage in the culture war?
Well, so if someone is telling you that critical race theory is being taught in schools, okay, so that's going to be a lie. It's just a straight up lie or misunderstanding. So some folks, they may not just understand, and so they think that it's critical race theory. But a lot of these folks out here, the Christopher Rufos and the James Lindsays, who are saying that, and some, you know, Republican politician who's saying that critical race theory is being taught in schools, that's not accurate. What critical race theory is, though, is sort of almost an it used to be this esoteric, very niche type of way of thinking about race and racism in the U.S., and it came out of law schools. It was a way of analyzing law and policy to try and understand how racism is reproduced in society. So that's sort of how it started. And it's trickled out of law schools since then, but most of the folks who are talking about race in society are not critical race theorists. They're just people who are talking about race. I mean, they call me a CRT-er, and I don't the critical race theory. So it's just a nice, catchy buzzword that a lot of Republicans and even some centrists can kind of use to just gin up some fear and push people into voting their way, I believe.
Yeah. What I'm noticing now is that it's trickling down into like school board meetings and board of supervisors and city council. And you got somebody up there like hollering into the microphone about like teaching the kids critical race theory. And they're like encompassing everything from like sex ed to Common Core in it. And I'm like, this can't all be this one thing that sounds like a very specific thing. Like before this, there was a panic around critical theory. A specific Mr. Jordan Peterson was kind of referring to critical theory as postmodern neo-Marxism, and it smell this thing right here just smells the exact same way to me. I don't know if you're well versed on critical theory, but what is the difference between critical theory and critical race theory, or to the extent that you understand it?
Well. Critical, I guess you could say that critical race theory is subsumed under critical theory. But in a broad sense, critical scholarship is just critiquing society. It's a sort of way of understanding whatever it is, gender, sex, race, right? Looking at things to critique society and figure out, okay, what is causing racism? What is causing sexism? What is causing all of these things? It's just a particular orientation that scholars can take. So, for example, I'm here at this university here, Old Dominion University, and I'm not a critical scholar. So the research that I do is very vanilla, you know, get some surveys, you know, collect some data and you know, do things that way. But there are a lot of critical scholars in my department, and these scholars are actually focusing on queer issues. And so their job as scholars is to critique society, right? And try and understand, okay, where is there homophobia or transphobia or whatnot, and how do we deal with it? So critical race theory is I guess the link is just critical. That's right. It.
It's funny because it's been made so damn complicated almost by the people who are supposedly opposing it. And like the way you just explained critical theory, I mean, I criticize society. I think everybody, if you examine society, you're going to have some criticisms of the way that it works. So maybe we're all critical theorists, no matter who we are.
Yeah, I think a lot of that pushback has to do with some of the assumptions in all of critical scholarship, right? Because it pushes back. So I don't know about Jordan Peterson, what he says, and I don't really follow him that much. But the general critique from a lot of folks, the critique of critical theory, is that critical theory and even critical race theory pushes back against these things such as objectivity, which a lot of people cherish, pushes back against what we call abstract liberalism, like all laws should be the same for everyone. And critical scholars will say, well, yeah, it may look that way, but let's look deeper. I mean, you know, it may seem like this law is the same for everyone, but it might be discriminatory. And so these kinds of critiques, a lot of folks don't like, because it's going against what they think are Western values. And so that's one reason. And another reason is because the focus in critical scholarship is always on sex, sexual minorities, racial minorities, women. Well, you know, if you're a white person, a straight white person, a straight rich white person, eventually you realize that there's nothing in that for me. And so you're gonna often push back against it for that reason, because the critique is to, in some ways, lower or level the playing field between you and other folks.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a gay person myself, but I'm fairly, like, I guess, heteronormative presenting, but the way I think about it, and maybe I'm just different than the people who are like mad about this, is if things are better for everybody, then I live in a better society, and that's going to end up being good for me in the end, not bad. I think like a more level society is it's going to be better for me. I, you know, if I lose some inherent advantage here, I may gain an advantage over there somewhere else. There may be something in it for me. And so the pushback, it's always the same pushback though. It's always the powerful trying to hold onto their power. That's the oldest story in history, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is the first song anybody ever sang was about trying to take power away from the powerful, you know?
Yeah. And they'll use all this big language, you know, like James Lindsay tries to use a bunch of you know, word mumble jumbo, but at the heart of it is just a kind of sense of precarity. Like, look, you know, these folks are pushing for a world that I don't want, socially or culturally. And so I don't want to say that I don't want black people having something, or I don't want gay people having something. So here's another way to do it. Let's push back against, you know, these esoteric ideas and make it appear as if we're concerned about, oh no, we're just concerned about the quality of research, or, oh, we're just concerned about, you know, whatever, anything but the real issue, which is they're afraid that their world will change in a way that they don't like. So I think that's the primary generator of all of this stuff.
Yeah, you had mentioned people, you know, they're like, oh, well, the law applies evenly to everybody. And like a really obvious example that comes up to me, and it's something that I believe was at least repealed on a federal level under the Obama administration, whereas let's turn the tables for fun. Let's say you had some powder cocaine and I had some rock cocaine, and we had the same exact amount of that substance, I would go to jail for a lot longer if I was convicted than the person with the powder cocaine. And that, sure, that law applies evenly to everyone, but that was, again, the result of another moral panic in the late 70s and the 80s about crack cocaine in the inner city. And that's how these sentencing guidelines came to be. And so dismantling that is dismantling something that isn't racist when you read the law, but then you go out into society and the law gets applied and then you're like, oh, this is being applied in a way that seems pretty fucking racist, actually, when you take a look at the history of how it came to be and then the results for different groups of people. Where, you know, I'm not a big fan of cocaine myself, but if I was gonna have some, I'd have some powder. And that's just like what's the fucking difference? It's illegal. Maybe it shouldn't be, but like, I don't, you know. And it doesn't, you don't have to do a whole lot of work, like intellectually or emotionally, to come up with the idea that maybe it was put there for a reason.
Yeah. The book that kind of, so people have been arguing about that for a while before it got, those laws got changed. And the person who really put that on the map was a critical race scholar. There aren't many, actually, people who are actually CRTers, but this person was, Michelle Alexander. And she was talking about this stuff in the 90s, and she came out with this book, The New Jim Crow, I believe.
She's been on Sam's show, Majority Report, yeah.
That's right, yeah. And so she was one of the main, and she's a legal scholar. She's one of the main people who started pointing out how these laws work against certain people. And so, that's a very good example.
Well, to me, it's like almost the most, it's like the most obvious one. Because it doesn't, you don't have to do a lot of work to get there on that one. There's other stuff where maybe you got to do a little bit more work. But on that one, no, if you can draw a straight line between that moral panic starting like 78, 79 about crack cocaine in the inner cities to the laws that made the rock cocaine harsher sentencing. This doesn't take a lot of work. You know, you just don't have to, you don't have to do a lot of work in your mind to get there.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now to get back to this, what's going on in schools and whatnot. There is race and racism being discussed in schools now more than when I was a kid. In fact, I heard nothing about this stuff when I was a kid. I had to learn it as an adult. And so there is something there, right? It's just not critical race theory. So if you are a high school social studies teacher, I guess, and you're using, and you're talking about white privilege, okay, that's not critical race theory per se, but it's an idea that a lot of white folks may not like. So they're pushing back against something. It's just not critical race theory. I would say, though, that those ideas are wonderful. Like those are not things that are just made up. Scholars have been talking about white privilege, whiteness, white supremacy, systemic racism, color blindness for decades. And finally, it's just trickled, as it should, trickled into grade school and in high school. Like all things do, right? Biologists and chemists, they learn stuff. They publish books. It gets in a textbook and then it's taught in grade school and high school. So it's really the same thing. There's nothing really strange about it. It's just that what they're saying just rubs some white people the wrong way. And then you get people who just kind of leverage that feeling and turn into this crazy thing we're seeing now on TV, you know, social media.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think back to high school and how, like, we were taught social studies. And I don't think race and racism came up outside of, like, history class and sort of talking about it in the past tense in our social studies school. Although I did have one great teacher who, like, we were reading about the Pilgrims and they were like, well, this book is not true. Like, this is what didn't happen, all right? That was good. That was good. A couple parents got mad about that, actually, now that you mention it. You know, coming back to, like, what's going on today, a couple parents got mad. The teacher was like...
Because the teacher...
They said, oh, this is what didn't happen. It was like the, you know, that that dumb Thanksgiving story we're all told about how the Pilgrims and the native people got together and the Pilgrims were taught how to grow corn. And, like, this is all bullshit, like, right? Like, and the teacher said so. And some of the parents got mad, but I mean, I grew up here in the Bay Area, so most of the parents were on the side of the teacher because, you know, I wouldn't say it's a leftist place, but it's a fairly liberal place. And the parents were fine with that because many of the parents knew that what the teacher was saying was true. And many of them may have even been ignorant to that and found out about it from their kids and maybe took a little bit deeper look and learned something themselves. But I think like a lot of other people, you know, in other areas of the country may have had different experiences. You know, geography is another big factor here. Geography is actually a huge factor.
Yeah. So I grew up in South Carolina, and I talked about this a little bit in one of my videos. I grew up in the age, as you did, of colorblindness, where we said, okay, Dr. King made this wonderful speech, and you know they passed some bills, and it's all done now, and so we don't need to talk about this race stuff anymore. And so when I was in school, this was in South Carolina, and you would think that would be, those would be some important conversations, but you know, school boards were predominantly white, and they're the ones choosing the textbooks. And so I knew nothing. I don't think I saw a picture of lynching until I went to, of course, I heard about it, but this wasn't something that we talked about. White violence, like the Tulsa massacre, none of these things. Slavery was talked about for two pages, maybe. This is South Carolina. You would think we would talk about that a little bit more. The impacts of slavery, we didn't talk about none of this stuff, like convict leasing, all these things that lead, you know, redlining, all these things that produce the disparities we see today. Things that are now being talked about, no one wanted to talk about it back then because we're in the age of colorblindness. And I think what's happening is, really, if I would take a sociological view of this, is that it's cohort effects. So let's say I'm a white person in my age. I'm 45, and I got a kid in school, 12, 13 years old, and I grew up in that age. In my mind, I'm thinking, why are they doing this? You know, everything seemed hunky-dory. We didn't even have to talk about this in high school, in grade school, none of that stuff. Dr. King did a good thing, you know, content of our character. We don't have to worry about this stuff. Now my kid's in school learning about how bad it was and white privilege and all this stuff. This is terrible. This is anti-white. I can understand that kind of cohort effect. Eventually, probably 20 years from now, the kids who are being taught about whiteness, white privilege and whatnot, and they become parents, it won't be a big deal. It won't seem like it's something strange. I'm quite confident it's gonna happen. But right now we have to go through this struggle right now.
Yeah, I don't think we were taught much about lynching other than it happened. I don't think that you know, what's funny is how I learned about redlining was when I got mad at Bill O'Reilly and he kept talking about Levittown, Levittown, Levittown. And then I looked up yeah. Levittown and I found out what redlining was.
No black people in Levittown were allowed in Levittown. These types of things, man, I mean, they have effects today, right? And so talking about them, I think is wonderful. In my opinion, if you don't learn those things, if you don't understand how we got to now, then what happens is when you see these racial disparities, yes, you're going to say in your head, I'm colorblind, I don't see color. But you're not stupid. You're going to see that, okay, this is happening more to black people and white people are over here. And you're going to try and understand why is it that black people have less wealth, less income, don't have the same type of jobs. You need a theory to explain that. And if you aren't taught how that happens, what you're going to do? You're going to say something's wrong with black people. So you kind of need those explanations to understand what's going on, right?
Well, so, and there's a whole like the word scholarship might not be the right way to talk about it, but there's like a whole sort of group of intellectual folks who are out there telling you that there's something wrong with black folks. You know, that the bell curve, that book looms large in our conversation about race. And it's, you know, I mean, I read it cause I was interested in it. And one of the things that, occurred to me was that it kind of debunks itself anyway, because one of the statistics in it was that, American black folks test higher on these tests than, sub-Saharan African folks. Right. And so it's like, well, you've just debunked your whole fucking theory, because we consider both of these groups to be black folks, but what we're looking at here is the environment. And, you know, it just kind of occurred to me there, but man, that's shit. And then before that it was phrenology, where they measure people's fucking skulls. Like there's always been some sciencey reason that somebody's going to come around and tell you why the racial disparities exist in society the way that they do. And it's never that there's bias, and that even as we remove biased laws, the, like you mentioned, redlining, that has to do with generational wealth. If you bought a house outside of Levittown, outside of the red line, your house did not increase in value as quickly as the people in Levittown. and you just it doesn't take very long. You know, that's the family house. It's passed down from generation to generation. The one's worth more than the other, and then it just increases in value more and more and more. And then, I mean, this is not, again, it's not complicated. You don't have to do a lot of work to understand like how that affects generational wealth. And that's just one little factor in one particular place that I happen to know about because I hate Bill O'Reilly. Right. And so, but there's just, this stuff's got to be all over society. Like the extent to which the average person is ignorant of it is vast. And it's not your fault either if you don't know about this stuff, but it just seems like a lot of people want to shut off the discussion and be like, no, it's because of this. You know, it's because of the family, the absence of the black father, all these things. And it's like, well, why are these things that way? And they're like, stop. You know, they want to stop there. A lot of people don't want to take that next step to be like, well, how did this happen? How did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that. They want to use a cultural explanation, right? So then I have to ask them, where does culture come from? Like, are you trying to tell me that black folk, or black Hispanic or poor people even actually, are just independently making a decision not to have a family? Or not study, like somehow they don't realize that that's the way to success in society. No, they're responding to things in their environment. That's what is creating the culture. Now, a lot of scholars know this, but a lot of politicians, that doesn't really help them to take that approach. I mean, like you have these rising rates of heroin addiction, heroin use in the Rust Belt. Okay, why? So all of a sudden, people in Cleveland or outside of Cleveland or something, white folks, primarily in these small, mid-sized towns, decided, okay, we don't want to work anymore, so I'm just going to start taking drugs. No, they're responding to something in their environment that is creating those problems. And so going back to black folk, if you create an environment where black folk don't have the same opportunities or the same pathways to success, they're going to do something different. So, I mean, and I think people know that, really. But if you acknowledge that problem, then that means that, you know, the next step would be to do something about it. And so you don't want to do that. And so you say, well, just blame them.
You know, another parallel there. I remember when I was, you know, going through school, like most girls weren't encouraged to do math. You know, everybody wanted them to do well on the test, but you know, the computers in the classes were for the boys. The math teachers mm-hmm. would tend to call on the boys more often and stuff. And now we see, you know, women trying to, you know, shake the ramp, like the reverberations of that off of them as they go want to be an engineer. And, you know, this didn't come from nowhere. It's the same fucking thing. The environment around in like in elementary school, high school, junior high, middle school, whatever, up until fairly recently, was that certain jobs were for boys and certain jobs were for girls. And, you know, mm-hmm. The way to retroactively fix that is to just hire more women engineers and to give them a little bit of a leg up. And nobody wants to do that because you're discriminating against men. It's like, well, what the fuck happened to this woman her whole life as she was trying to be an engineer? Wasn't she discriminated against? You know, it's like,
this is why people don't like critical theory or critical scholarship, because once you start making that argument about, and you're correct, that there are certain gender norms in place which made it more difficult for women to go into science and math. They were pushed into either not into science and math or in some kind of job that might be less rewarding or doesn't pay as much. You know, they didn't have the same amount of options. Once you make that argument, which is a classic, you know, kind of critical way of looking at it, once you make that argument, then the next step is to try and rectify it. So you don't want to go that far. So one, you try to say, well, look, there's something wrong with critical scholarship. It's not real science or something, whatever. Or you come up with an explanation to justify those differences. So Charles Murray uses the IQ for race. He does it with men too, men and women too.
Yeah.
He says, oh, you know, men, you know, score higher on the, how does it work? Women might have, as a group, equal or even a little bit higher intelligence than men, but you have more men at the far end of the bright of distribution, they're more likely to be geniuses or very high IQ, something like that. And that explains why you have men who are getting more Nobel Prizes or something of that nature. And that's the process with everything. They're always going to either, they're going to dismiss the ideas and say there's something wrong with the ideas, and then they're going to give an alternative explanation that justifies the inequality.
You know, the thing that occurs to me there too is when I run into people, and this is like anecdotal, right? But when I run into people who are highly successful, these people are not always the people who I think, you know what, that's a really bright fucking person. These are the people I meet who are driven and who are know what they want. And so like just raw problem solving horsepower is like almost oversampled for or overrated anyway when we think about how successful people are. Because I know people who are more successful than me to the best that I can figure out, I think I have a little more raw problem solving horsepower, but they're just better at getting their shit done than I am, you know? And
yeah.
So it's like we're kind of over, like when we start to talk about intelligence as just this one thing as a predictor for success, we're just like, we're taking so much other important stuff off the table anyway. Like, especially in the business world, you have to be able to work with other people. You have to be able to, I don't know, respect other people. You have to be able to show up on time every day. You have to be, you know, fairly like mentally healthy to succeed in business, because otherwise, you know, like, well, it's just going to be hard for other people to work with you, even if it's no fault of your own. So we're like taking all this other stuff off the table that also like it indicates success. And it's just, it's probably because we don't want to address like all these other things and how people are socialized into these other important things that might indicate success. And especially here where I live in Silicon Valley, honestly, there's just a boys club in tech. That's all there is. It's just a fucking boys club. And, you know, it's ruined tech, but it's also ruined nightlife here. You go out, there's not a lot of women. They call it Man Jose. All the girls are at the gay. All the girls are at the gay club because like they don't want to deal with all these bros. And like the dudes at the gay club are actually nice to them. Well, not, I mean, right now we're just getting ready to open back up, thankfully. But I was saying, we're leaving all this other stuff on the table that like might even indicate success more than just being like at the far end of, you know, whatever the intelligence scale is to the degree that we can even measure that in the first place.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes, it's just amazing the things that come up with men. Or they'll say that guys are thing-oriented and women are...
People-oriented. Calling them gossipy, right? I mean, that's what they're doing. That's what they're saying, is that women are gossipy and men like to build models or whatever, you know?
Right. Which I'm going to tell you, even if some of that is true, in a job that's very complex, I find that... the personalities, the people who have the personalities that they can deal with other people, they tend to do better anyway.
They're certainly better leaders.
They're better leaders. They're better. So, okay, if I stay in my office here, so suppose I was a genius, which I am not. Suppose I was a genius.
Me neither.
And I was and I was in my office and I was looking at computer code all day. R code all day, and I come up with this brilliant idea. That's going nowhere, man. It's much better to be the person. Oh, I'm sorry, I got this thing on. It's much better to be the person who is able to identify people that you can work with, set up a, like you said, kind of like a leader, set up a some sort of collaboration with those folks. Two or three people get together, come up with a good idea. Then that person needs to be able to market that idea or in my case, maybe find the right publication. You have to think about that. Like these are things that aren't, you know, oh, I'm a genius. I'm good with building models. That's not going to be successful, at least not in this field. And I think many fields are that way. So if it was the case that women are better people or something, then they should be dominating in most of these fields now.
Right, and they should be running the businesses.
Yes. So, and I'm seeing it actually in academia. I think people being very intelligent as a professor only gets you so far. It's just more important to have good social skills, to be able to work with people, to plan, to be organized, to have discipline. Right. So, yeah, I thought those ideas, and I think. critical theory and critical race theory are critiquing this white black this white supremacist supremacist society. A word that I didn't even hear about growing up when I was in high school. Like what? Like 10, 15 years ago, when I started hearing white supremacists, I was like, what are they talking about? Because in my mind, I'm imagining a bunch of white people pulling strings and, you know. But as I've read more about it, I understand what it means and what they're getting at. And it's absolutely true that white folks tend to control most of the wealth and they tend to control most of the media. White men especially. And that has some negative consequences for other people. And so I understand that idea now more than before.
Yeah, when I was coming up, if somebody said white supremacy, I would immediately just think of the hood and the fire, you know. It was like that, it was,
right.
You know, like, and like that's sure that exists, but that's not what's causing problems for most people, and hopefully that remains the case, right? Like let's not bring that back, but that's not what's causing problems for most people in society, and it's the system, and it's, you know, ramifications of old laws that have been overturned. It's just networks, like just your network. Like if your parents went to Harvard, then you go to Harvard, and now you have this network, and that's much more likely to happen for like a white family. That's just the way that it is.
That's right. And much more likely for a white family, and also a wealthy, rich white family. But yeah, that's true. That's true.
So what I wanted to ask, because you're a sociologist, I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about moral panics a little more broadly, and just like, what do you think that, like, as individuals, I don't know what we can do to like kind of immunize ourselves against the next moral panic, but what do you think we can do on like a society level to kind of immunize ourselves and others and our groups against moral panics, like what's going on with critical race theory right now?
I tell you, I really don't know. If this was 10 years ago, I would say the internet's great for diffusing information, you know, and now I realize no. Well, what it does is puts people in silos and it gets worse. So I really don't know how to deal with those issues. I mean, the easy answer would be, okay, you teach kids, you know, how to evaluate information and evaluate sources and whatnot. I really don't know.
No, it's okay. This is a space where it's fine, where people don't know things.
And that's a terrible answer.
But it's the truth. I mean, like, I like people who say that they don't know, because that they're usually telling the truth. Why would you, you know, unless you're talking to the police, then you just don't know anything. That's, no matter who you are, I'm telling you, unless you got to call them because somebody came and robbed your house, you don't talk to them. So just real quick here, before we get out of here, I noticed you were posting a little bit about the manosphere on Twitter, maybe like a week and a half ago. And I kind of wanted to just really quickly, because I've had a lot of run-ins with those fucking, the sort of men's rights activist people. I've had so many run-ins with them over the years. And like, it looked like you were kind of looking into things and seeing what was going on in different communities and stuff. And I'm just wondering if you kind of came across anything interesting about like the sort of men's like advocacy for issues that affect men versus what we traditionally is a weird word to talk about it, what we generally call men's rights activism.
Yeah, so that manosphere space is it's filled with a lot of groups, one of which is men's rights activists, and so I'm not even as interested in the MRAs as I am these groups like the Pickup Artists and the Red Pillars and MGTOWs, you know, men going their own way. It's just very interesting groups. Yeah, I posted a lot on Twitter and I stopped. You know, I still do it a little bit, but I realized that what happens is, one, people will respond in a way that you did, but say, oh, it's just toxic. Oh, these guys are, you know, crazy, you know, this type of thing. And or two, the conversation bends to women in a weird way, right? Someone will say, well, what about women? And so I said, well, I don't know if Twitter is the best platform for that. So I might do some videos on YouTube. But the reason why I'm doing this is because there are trends that are troubling for dudes. High school graduation rates, college graduation rates, suicide, drug addiction, alcoholism, these things are bending towards or disproportionately affecting men. So women do have problems too. So what tends to happen is when I try to talk about those issues, and I say that, and I try to say, well, there needs to be a manosphere to talk about those things. Then, you know, people say, well, what about women? And or they'll say, you know, it's toxic. It doesn't have to be that way. It really doesn't. I think that the same way I would not try and speculate on what a gay person goes through, or a trans person goes through, or a woman goes through, I'm not entirely sure that that doesn't apply to men too. So I like talking to a guy who can understand what I might be going through. So suppose we have this gender norm that men are supposed to be providers. I'm not saying it has to be that way, but that is certainly how we see men in society right now. So that's the reality. Okay, and we're seeing this trend where men are simply not able to be providers. Okay, if you're a guy and you're struggling with this, you want to talk about it. You may not get the kind of response you want if you're talking to an unsympathetic crowd or to women, because they're not in your shoes. So you might want to do that in a men's group. And that's where I think the manosphere can be beneficial. But right now, it's filled with, it's a lot of pickup artists, like 10 ways to get women. If you do these 10 steps, it's like a program. If you do these 10 steps, then you're gonna get this chicken bed. Or they talk about some horrible things, man. So are you, do you watch any of the manosphere content?
At first, when I saw like men's rights activism kind of start to crop up in like 2010, or at least the version that we have of it now, like on the internet, the kind of YouTubeized version of it, at first I thought it was satire. I was like, this must be satire. Not because I don't think men have issues. That's like why I like brought this up. It was because the way it was being presented was silly, not in funny, but like silly and like, you are so anti-feminist that this like just. This would be satire. This wouldn't be make a pretty good satire of just a misogynist. And then the more I looked into it, I was like, no, some of these dudes really believe this. And I'm like, these dudes have real problems. And all that happens, like you're saying, for example, the men who are having a hard time dating for the reasons maybe you brought up, because we do live in a society where men are pressured to be the provider. And maybe they're not, you know, their career's not going so well or whatever. And maybe, they have a little bit of anxiety around that or whatever. Well, if that guy shows up and the problem isn't addressed as, a problem, isn't addressed, I guess, in a critical way. And instead, it's just like they just blame women for it. And that's like really the only place they can show up anywhere, because that's what YouTube's starting to recommend to them. That's kind of a problem. There's nowhere for those guys to go other than down a nasty rabbit hole. And then, at the bottom of that rabbit hole isn't just sexism. Like there's like white nationalists recruit in those spaces too, because there's like a lot of aggrieved white men in those spaces. And so I followed it from, through like basically when I first found it, maybe 2010 through 2011, through an incident in the, atheist skeptic community where called Elevator Gate, where a woman said that, hey, don't hit on me in the elevator, that's creepy, you can't leave the elevator, because there weren't a lot of women at the atheist conferences. It was Rebecca Watson, she's a pretty popular figure, and then they piled on her instead of, because that's pretty good advice actually, don't hit on nobody in the elevator, because they can't leave if they want to. Also, they had just left a social event, so the he could have spoken to her there. And I followed that through Gamergate, where they just piled on a few women. They aren't perfect people or whatever, but those women didn't deserve that pile on. They were just part of the gaming community too. And then I watched the alt-right come along and started to hear some of that same lingo about people being cucks that I heard come out of the manosphere. And I was like, oh, this is getting, this is bad. And then now we're here, and I'm feeling like that kind of same vibe coming out of the conversation about critical race theory, though. That's not they're not using the same words, but I'm like, it's some of even the same fucking people from Gamergate are talking about it now. And I get big Gamergate vibes from the way that this critical race theory is being spread, at least on Twitter, like the way that the conversation is happening, who's spreading it and how it's being spread. and it I can't like put my finger on exactly what it is, but I get that vibe from it, that it's the same kind of moral panic about basically people who don't have the power kind of almost trying to elbow their way into somebody else's space, and the people who are already in that space are fucking not happy about it.
Okay, so this is interesting. So, all right, are you saying that the same people who are in the manosphere are now also, which I buy, makes sense, are also in the anti-CRT sphere? Or are you saying that it's just the same phenomenon? People are aggrieved and looking for something.
To a small extent, it's the same people.
Okay.
But to a larger extent, it's the latter, that it's, you know, in specifically Gamergate, it's that, you know, we're the powerful people in this community, and that by we I mean young white men. We call the shots in the chats, the group chats on the forums. What are these women doing here? And then the anti-CRT thing is, we again, it's going to be usually in this case, I guess, middle-aged white men control the power in society, and we don't want you elbowing your way into like the power in society. It feels the same, and the way that it's being propagated on Twitter, it just feels like the same kind of creepy and icky and like dishonest and trying to look over here at this thing when they're really talking about this thing over here, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me, especially with the anti-CRT stuff. I mean, and it's easy to fall for that. I mean, you're on Twitter, and someone posts a clip from some PowerPoint presentation that some random activist did, and it's poorly worded and it's out of context, and it says something about white people are inherently racist or something of that nature. And then you post that on Twitter, and you go, and you see the caption. See, this is what, you know, and this is what CRT is. You know, it's saying that you are inherently bad. And if you're coming, you know, you don't know what's going on, and you're just on Twitter trying to look for jokes or something, and then you see this thing, you go, wow, this CRT thing is terrible, right? And then, you know, you go off the deep end. But to get back to this, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, the same thing happened during Gamergate. They'd take just one of these women, it was always women, like out of context, mm-hmm. and they'd say, oh, well, this community's toxic and it's full of white guys and they're sexist. And they're like, how can a game, you know, how can a game be toxic and sexist? It's like, it's not the video game, you idiot. It's the community you made around it. And so it's not one-to-one, but it's pretty close. You know, it's the way that it's being propagated and the way that you described what's happening with critical race theory, I probably never would have described it in that way. But yeah, it's almost the same thing. And it just feels like it's just the same fucking moral panic again. We're just replacing a few of the nouns.
I buy that. I want to put a bow on that manosphere thing. For anyone who's listening, I think that space is pretty toxic. But the idea is, if you can put more sane people in that space with some sane content creators, then eventually, you know, it'll be a guy could go on YouTube and try and understand, you know, why he's having trouble with dates. And instead of getting this sort of red pill, you know, women are selfish and this is how you can trick them, da da da, you might get some actual good advice from some guy in that space. And so that's kind of what I'm hoping for. And I hope that eventually that'll happen.
Yeah, like good advice in that space might be like, hey, what are you interested in? Go find things that you're interested in. Go do activities related to your interests. Maybe there's women there and you might share some ideas. It's a lot harder to convince someone of that than, you know, well, here's your seven ways to trick a woman into sleeping with you. But I don't think you should ever trick anybody into sleeping with you. They should do it because they want to, right? Like that's pretty simple. Yeah. It's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. You know, if I find out after I have sex with somebody that they weren't that into it, I'm like, well, that sucks. You know, but I guess, you know, in the idea that a woman is like a conquest or whatever is kind of at the root of that. And that's sort of, we need to find a way to kind of shake that out of people somehow, because that's actually just another fucking human being. And the other idea is that like women have to be coerced into sex and that they don't like sex. And that's just icky too. Cause like women like sex too. Actually, people like good sex. That's why they call it good sex. Well, Rod, thanks so much for joining me. I I had a lot of fun, and I'd like to do this again sometime. And before we get out of here, what's your website?
Well, so my website, you can just go to RoderickGraham.com, and that's a one-stop shop. That's the YouTube channel. That's the Twitter feed, essays, articles, whatnot.
Well, fantastic. Thanks again.
Thank you.